For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week, with winter on its way, Sally Gardner introduces us to Snow Song, her fairy tale for adults. Alex Court and Tanika Smith discussed their book Mixed Up, Confessions of an Interracial Couple, and their very personal reason for recording it as an audiobook. And with Robert still laid up with a broken ankle, we return to one of his favourite interviews of 2020. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Sally Gardner is an award-winning children's author who has sold over 2.5 million copies of her books worldwide. Her latest novel, The Snow Song, is her third book for adults and showcases her gift for combining intricate historical fiction with elements of magical realism. Set against a beautiful but foreboding landscape, it explores toxic masculinity and burgeoning feminism. Here's Sally to tell us more.
Basically, it is a story about a small community stuck high up on a mountain that become completely isolated in the drifts of snow. And it's about a young girl who lives in this village who falls in love with a shepherd. And the shepherd says to her, "When I return, we will get married and I will return before the snow comes." And into this comes the butcher, who has his eyes on Edith, and he makes her drunken father take her to the mayor to swear that if the shepherd doesn't return, Edith will marry him. And when the snow comes and there is no sign of the shepherd, Edith loses the power of speech. She becomes completely silent. And what she finds in her silence, which is all to do with her grief of the loss of her love, is a great power to listen and to really let other people tell their stories to her. And what unfolds is a sort of whole load of stories about the people who she's involved in this village. And in that silence, there is a great magic and a great power.
It's a modern fairy tale take on the power of tradition.
Yes, it is about superstition. It's about the way women are made to live rather small lives due to fear and tied to traditions that are really outdated, have nothing to do with the time or the place they're in, but they're always being done. And the place I set this in is in Transylvania, a sort of made-up Transylvania, because due to COVID, I never really got there. But what is interesting about that is there's sections in Transylvania. For instance, there were the Saxons who came to Transylvania, and they believed they were the children of the Pied Piper, that when the Pied Piper went through the mountain, he had come out in the Carpathian Mountains, and they lived a more Germanic life in Transylvania than even the Germans did. And then there were the Romanians, and then there were the Gypsies, and the Saxons refused to mix at all, and they stuck completely to their traditions. And it's this group of people that really began to fascinate me.
And that suspicion of outsiders, that mistrust of anything different, pervades the book. In fact, Demetrius, the shepherd, is wrongly accused of being a gypsy to scare Edith off wanting to be with him.
Yes. The story of the gypsies in their own right, the Romany people, is one of the great heartaches, I think, of this planet. I mean, we have been so unmitigatedly cruel to them, and they have suffered so desperately, really. And I really wanted to deal with that feeling, the sense of the outsider, the sense of the unwanted. And of course, Demetrius is thrilled to be thought of as a gypsy. He thinks, you know, the best music in the world has come from them, some of the best stories he's ever heard. And so he has no fear of them, and neither has Edith, who is our central character. Her grandmother went off with the gypsies, with the circus. And so she doesn't have this fear of them, but to the other villagers, they believe their whole livelihoods are in jeopardy.
The contrast between the beautiful, picturesque setting of the village and the corruption and unpleasantness that lies behind its door is really played out in the character of the butcher and all the people he controls, because he does give them food. They do owe him favours, and he has a huge amount of power over this community.
Yes, there's so many people in the world at the moment who have a huge amount of power over people. And I feel it's very much of the moment that. And he does, he controls everything. except one thing that he can't control, which is his obsession with Edith. And that is also quite interesting, I think, that in a way Edith does manage to get the better of him.
As we said, the book is told in the form of a fairy tale, and you have been fascinated by fairy tales throughout your writing life. I know that you've adapted both Snow White and Cinderella for a very young audience, and you've spoken about being a fan of Grimm's fairy tales. What is it about the medium of fairy tales that you think is so enduring and powerful?
Well, I think a good way of putting it is one fairy tale. Let's take Hansel and Gretel. So Hansel and Gretel can be read in three ways. For the happy child, the child that has got a lovely family, Hansel and Gretel can be read as a story where children go for a picnic with their parents, and their parents say, go and play while, you know, mummy and daddy have a little cuddle. And they go off and they see the gingerbread house. And it smells of rotten vegetables and it's disgusting. And the parents find the children and go, oh, my darlings, you'll never see such a hideous house again. And then the unhappy child has tasted the gingerbread house, whereas the traumatized child knows the feel of the witch's bony finger. And in that sense, that story really hits all the beats it needs to. So it can be taken very lightly. It can be taken as something to be worked on, and it can be taken as something recognised. And I think the thing about fairy stories, it's a way of helping the psyche work out a lot of what's going on within you. For instance, Cinderella, if you ask a child, what's your favourite fairy story? And they'll say, Cinderella. And you know almost by that one statement that they've got a baby brother or sister has just turned up. I mean, they are very brilliant at, I call them the sort of soul of the world, our soul. They hit the beat to our soul and they allow us to stand outside the dark, dark wood or go into the dark, dark wood. Or as I am, I sort of set up house in the middle of the dark, dark wood. But you can go as far into them or as far back from them as you wish to. I always think Disney stands very far back. His feet are very firmly in modernity and commerce. They don't really go into the wild, wild woods. He went once with Snow White, but I don't know if he's done it again.
They also tend to focus on small, usually closed communities and the friction that members of those communities have between each other, the will to control your fellow men. And that's something that's particularly resonant this year as we are all having to live a bit closer to our neighbours.
When I started Snow Song, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was sort of thinking, oh, I don't know, what's the relevance of it? What is this? What are you trying to say? And then we all went into lockdown. And I thought, oh my word, I know where this book's going. I know what this book's about. So it was for me a very good thing that it happened. And also, as a writer, I'm usually going off doing masses of things. Like I go to school to do this, I do that. I'm on trains a lot of the time. And the most wonderful thing about this lockdown was the phone stopped and it was just peaceful and I could write. And funnily enough, I thought, well, isn't that what writers are supposed to do? But in all the sort of pressure to get things ready for fairs, to get things ready for this, writing often is a very flustered and worried affair, not peaceful.
I was wondering how you go about deciding, if that's the right word, whether a book is for an adult audience or for an audience of children?
Well, it's a very, very good question. And I'd like to think this one is a bit more like a Charles Dickens in a way a young adult could read it easily. When I'm writing for very little children, I know what I'm doing for them. I am a shepherd for them in a way, but it doesn't make me stop showing some brutality, but I'm still mindful of being a shepherd. Does that make sense?
It does. You recognise that there are threats out there in the world, but you are there to protect your reader from the worst excesses.
Yes, I am. Or at least I'm there to try and help them see the worst excesses in a way that might make them understand it. But I'm not there to give any moral lessons. You know, I'm not there to sort of give a big message about life. I'm really there as a storyteller, as someone who doesn't want the sheep to go over the edge of the cliff?
Part of my reason for asking the question is because I received a pre-publication copy and my 18-year-old daughter picked it up, saying, because she's read several of your books as a younger reader, and she recognised your name. And I said, oh, I think it's a book for adults. And she said, well, you wouldn't be able to tell by the cover. She said it was a cover that would appeal to readers of all ages. For a blind audience, could you describe the cover?
Yes, I can. It's a rather nice blue, and it's got a big white circle in the middle, and the writing is in the white. It's as if it's a little snow globe. And on the blue, it's sort of as if it's cut out with leaves going round it, and a snowflake, and a little violin. And then on the white, which is like the snow dome, it's got a little cottage and a forest. And at the bottom, there's a cuckoo clock. And then it says my name, Sally Gardner. But it does say on the back, a spellbinding fable for adults. I think from about 13 upwards, you'd be fine to read it. But obviously, if you're very, very little, I don't think you'd understand what was going on. You'd be bored.
I will, of course, have the audiobook version to enjoy, which I believe is being recorded at the moment.
It's being recorded by Amanda White, and I'm really excited about this. I had Rachel Atkins do most of my books, but we just thought a change would be exciting, and she's got a lovely voice. Audio is so important to me. I mean, it's everything to me.
It was the sound of his violin that first cast a spell on Edith. Even before she saw him, the restless notes of his melody drew her to him. The musician was sitting on a bench outside the cobbler's, a pair of new boots beside him. The morning sunshine illuminated his outline, striking against the burnt orange of the cobbler's house. The violin looked to Edith as if it were made of liquid honey, so polished was its surface. The rhythm of the song, with its languid melancholy, echoed her own feelings. His music danced into her heart to free her troubled soul from its cage, and she stood mesmerized. When he had finished, he looked up at her, his eyes the colour of a blue winter sky, his hair dark like her own, his face elegant in its composition, generous lips, a straight nose, unlike the young men of her village with their blonde, dumpling faces that lacked definition, as if they had all been baked in the same oven.
Amanda White, narrating Snow Song, written by my guest, Sally Gardner. And Sally, as you say, audiobooks are incredibly important to you.
Oh, they're everything. I mean, I love the RNIB. I am so full of admiration for you as a charity. For a start, you managed to claim it back so that it is run by the blind and partial sighted more than it is by sighted. I think you've done an amazing job. And bless your cotton socks, you allow dyslexic people in for being word blind. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. And I came across you rather late in my life, and then I couldn't stop listening. I've done so much listening through the RNIB. I had those clunky recordings that used to come through the letterbox. I used to love it because I would hear the bong. I think, oh, it's arrived. It's arrived. I remember listening to Madame Bovary, read by some dear man, no actor. And the thing that I loved about it was that he read it like this, Madame Bovary, chapter one, da, 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 da. And to me, it just became a line of text that you could play with in your head so that you could make the characters do what you wanted them to do. The thing that I loved about the RNIB recordings was the straight reading. I know nowadays everything's acted and everyone loves it and goes, it's a wonderful performance. But I don't know about you, but I still today love someone reading da, 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 and just using the grammar to do the reading so that you're allowed to make your own Mr. Darcy and you're allowed to make your own characters up. Whereas if it's acted, you are given a performance. Years ago, I went to a conference on audio and they were actually advocating not losing straight reading. But today, everyone wants something acted. But I do think children have the right to have Stephen Fry read Harry Potter, but they've also, I think, got the right to have it read so they could make up their own Harry Potter.
Now, as you say, you are dyslexic, and I believe you didn't actually read your first book until you were 14 years old.
Yes, that's right. I read Wuthering Heights. Reading has always, and still is, you know, complicated for me. I mean, the words, they go like a little band. They go wobble, 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 like ribbon, an unstable ribbon of words, I would call them. So I'm constantly battling that. So text, how things are laid out, especially for young people, is very important to me, that I feel things should be made as readable as possible. A lot of my work now is printed in dyslexia font to help people with the reading. And we did Maggot Moon in dyslexia font. And funnily enough, we discovered that actually the dyslexia font was rather outselling the straight font, because I think a lot of people are not diagnosed and a lot of people have trouble with keeping words stable on paper. Mm. And it's not talked about very much.
And you are an ambassador for the Listening Books charity.
I am indeed.
Not everybody would expect somebody with profound dyslexia to end up becoming one of the more successful novelists in the country. But you actually believe that dyslexia can be a gift so long as your self-confidence isn't destroyed by the negativity of your teachers.
Yes, I mean, I describe it as being a sort of present given to you by a mad aunt who then decides to wrap it up in lots and lots of paper and then thought had a brainwave to dip it in cement and then decides to wrap it up in more paper and give it to you when you were five. And really, you take this thing to school. Everyone else has opened their little present. Oh, look, I'm good at games. Oh, I'm very good at reading. I can do maths. And you're sort of left with your horrible little concreted present, which you can't get the wrapping paper off. And for a lot of people with the level of dyslexia I possess, that they just give up. They just think, oh, I know I'm never going to get it open. I'll never know. And their cleverness is wasted. A lot of very clever people are wasted. But if you do manage to get it off and you do manage to discover what you've got, I do think it is a great gift. But it also is subjected to not losing confidence. Self-confidence is something I battle with. I'm terrified of saying names round the wrong way. I'm terrified of writing things the wrong way round. I still live in fear, even now, of my dyslexia.
And you worked in the theatre for 15 years before becoming a novelist. Do you think that was also a way of helping you discover how you could control words and express yourself?
I think anyone who wants to be a writer, may I suggest if the theatres ever open again, you go and work there. Because honestly, to really see story live and to see story die, work in a theatre. Because there's nothing better to watching an audience listening to a play and seeing the front row fall asleep and wondering what it was that made them all fall asleep and why weren't they on the edge of their seats and how do you keep them on the edge of the seats without just producing a gun. And that is a fascinating lesson, and without doubt it gave me a great deal. I think in a way it made me a writer, though I didn't realize that's what was happening at the time.
You are notoriously industrious, so I am guessing that you're already working on your next novel. Is that for children or for adults?
Well, at the moment, I'm doing a whole four books on a thing called The Tin Dims of Rubbish Island, which is about the oldest recyclers in the world. And they're very small, and they live on Rubbish Island, and they're really rather magical creatures. And I'm thoroughly enjoying doing that. I'm about to start book four. So I've done three of them already. And then I will have to see what I'm on to next.
And of course, the audiobook versions of those will also be produced.
Yes, and I'm reading them. That's the first time. I'm so excited about it. I'm actually going to record them. So I'm really, really chuffed about that. Yeah.
Well, you heard it here first. And I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life with the listeners.
I'd love to.
Well, in the meantime, Sally Gardner, thank you so much for introducing us into the magical and claustrophobic world of Snow Song and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you so much for having me.
A wide selection of books by Sally Gardner is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. And Sally will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we hear from Robert Kirkwood...
Just over 10% of British adults is in an interracial relationship, and the number is rising. But as the fevered media reaction to the marriage between Prince Harry and Meghan Markle has shown, acceptance is far from a foregone conclusion. Tanika Smith and Alex Court are likewise a black American woman and a white British man who've got married. And in their audiobook, Mixed Up, Confessions of an Interracial Couple, they explore the reactions that they've received to their personal relationship. Alex and Tanika, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having us, Red.
Thank you so much for having us.
Tanika, if I can begin with you, can you tell us a bit about your background and how you and Alex met?
So I am African American and I grew up in the US on the East Coast. My dad was a naval officer, so I moved around a lot in the US. I always wanted to live abroad and study abroad. So when I got the chance to do my master's at City University in London, you know, I leapt at it. I was very excited to do that. And so that is actually how I moved to Britain. And I had never actually been to Britain before that time. And I met Alex on my master's course and we became friends and soon we became flatmates. And that's how we met. We had a strong friendship actually before we started entering into a relationship. The move over to Britain was quite interesting for me because I think, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of Black people have realized that they have so many feelings that they've suppressed over the years. And this is something that really, I think, is done in a mode of survival and preservation of sanity. And when I wrote the book, I was really able to reflect on how moving to Britain is when I started to feel uncomfortable and my own skin, because that was the first time I was really confronted with my identity. I'd tell people, you know, I'm African American, and then they would assume that I'm not really American. They'd assume that I went to international school, and so that's how I have this accent, or I practiced to have this accent, and I was African. So it was just an interesting notion, and for me, I think it really showed that, you know, there's a sense within Britain that people really understand the United States and they really understand Americans and were made fun of abroad. But it made me realize that when it comes to race and identity within the United States, many Britons don't know as much as they think they know. So the concept of me being an African-American woman was something that I actually had to come to terms with or realize. And a lot of times now I just say I'm Black, to avoid a whole conversation around that as well.
And Alex, you were born and brought up in Britain. You're white. And you explore the other side of this, how in some ways our acceptance of white privilege is more insidious than the racism on the other side of the pond.
Yeah, indeed. I think that many people, certainly many of my peers, would assume that they're not racist and they're very aware of what racism means and how they can actually be a positive force in combating racism. Whereas in fact, it really does take a lot of introspection and a lot of self-criticism to really confront your own white privilege. And that's something which has taken me certainly many, many years. And as I express in the book, I don't know whether I would have embarked on that journey had I not been married to Tanika and seen the way that she has a completely different experience, mainly because of her racial status. And even though we can be in the same place with the same people, we can have completely different experiences. And what I try to break down in the book is, first of all, just how you recognize your own white privilege. And that's not to say that it's your fault or it's necessarily something which you need to throw completely away, but you need to be very, very aware of it and aware of the privilege which comes your way because of being a white person and particularly a white man.
And that privilege comes with a cost, whilst one person might benefit from it, somebody else will lose by it.
Exactly.
That's exactly right. And racism, I think, was very much taught to me as something which is a negative thing which happens to other people. Certainly in my education, there wasn't enough focus on the kind of other side of that coin, which is the oppression of certain people means the elevation of others. And if we can be more joined up when it comes to people from different races, working together, living together, being together, building a society together, then that means both sides and both types of people can benefit as well. It's not that white privilege is a bad thing which needs to be completely broken down. It's a structural thing that is a real part of our society. And first of all, we really need to recognize that in order to start breaking it down.
And Tanika, you point out that it's not just racism from white people that you have been subjected to, but actually hostility from black people for your marriage to a white man.
Yes, unfortunately, that is the case. I obviously would say that I don't get that from friends and family, but from strangers who don't know me or new acquaintances, yeah, that's definitely something that I experience. There's also kind of this assumption that we're not together, or sometimes just judgment. And I speak in the book about a time where a black man saw me kiss Alex, and Alex had to go somewhere else, and this guy followed me for about 10 minutes and then spit in my face. Yeah, it was a horrible moment. And I've been in conversations with other black men or men of color who have openly asked why or criticized me being with a white person or dating white people in general, and encouraging me to date people of my own race. And so there's almost like this assumption where it seems that men feel like they are able to tell me how to date and who to date, but it doesn't seem to be a reverse thing as well. These same people who have criticized me have then dated white women. And so, yeah, gender definitely plays a factor in that as well.
I think that's something that would also chime with many blind people and their partners, that the assumption that our sighted partner is our carer and that nobody would actually want to marry a blind person is one of the most hurtful things that I think my wife and I have come up against. And it's born of ignorance and fear of the unknown. And it's something that both of you explore in your own stories and together in the book.
Definitely. I think ignorance is a major factor that we try to deal with, because for me, certainly, it's not that I was completely unaware of racism, but I had learned about it in a very kind of academic sense. But I hadn't really been face to face with it in a day to day situation until really Tanika and I had been together and gotten married. And I'm not talking about necessarily overt racism, which is super in your face. Slight microaggression experience or Tanika experiences, and I have to look on in horror often. And that is a real challenge, which I was ignorant about before. And I've had to go through this learning experience about just how painful that is.
I think that in terms of the ignorance of other people, the main thing is the assumption that we're not together. So neighbors will say, oh, yeah, that's your flatmate, right? But it's almost like they know we're together, but it's like they want to convince themselves that it isn't true. I don't understand, you know, questions like that. Or, you know, we'll be holding hands in a store. We both have our wedding rings on, and like, they'll serve Alex and then they'll say, can I help you? And, you know, I think there was one instance where I was like, no, we're clearly together. And then they're like, oh, I'm laughing as we walked out the store. We think that we live in a post-racial world and it's 2020 and we've really progressed. And honestly, I truly believe that we haven't progressed in terms of racism. I think it's become more insidious. Living in Europe for over 10 years, the main thing I've heard is that's an American thing. Don't bring that over here. If I tell someone that what they're saying is racist or racially inappropriate. But the thing about the US is most of it is overt. And what I've noticed in Europe is it's quite insidious. And there's just almost a denial of its existence. And in some ways, I think it's more dangerous because in the States, it's overt and there are protests and people are whipping out their videos anytime they see anyone of color being treated in a certain way. There's a reaction. But in places like the UK, there's been this denial for so long, and it really is all based on ignorance and not accepting that racism is actually an issue.
And it's something that has also been very much in evidence in the media's treatment of the marriage between Prince Harry and Meghan Markle.
Absolutely. It's so interesting because after Prince Harry and Meghan Markle decided to step back from their royal duties, there was this kind of backlash where people were just kind of like, it's because of the racism they experienced, the targeting from the press. And a lot of the headlines were just like, I think there was a comment made by someone in the Mail on Sunday about their bloodline being thickened with exotic blood. I mean, it's just horrible. But the issue, I think, with a lot of British press is they didn't want to acknowledge that A, racism plays a part, and that B, they played a part in it. Interracial couples experience more pressure. They have that added racial layer, and sometimes there's just a refusal to acknowledge that. And we can see, I mean, comparisons between Meghan Markle and Kate, between how they reported their pregnancies or outfits, and it's just so amazing to see a similar report and the difference in headlines. She was absolutely targeted, without a doubt.
Fortunately, both of you have parents who are more open-minded than the British media. And in the book, each of you details a conversation that you had when you were younger, where your fathers said that choice was open to you as to whom you married. Alex, you first.
Yeah, it was a really brief conversation that I had with my dad when I was less than 10 years old. And it's amazing to think back now just how big an impact that has had on my entire life. And I am very fortunate that both my parents are very open-minded. They've taken the time to really learn about other cultures all around the world. They've traveled quite well and challenged themselves to different people. And I think what happened in that conversation with my dad is that not only did he say it's okay to marry someone who is black or Asian, but it would be okay for me to marry someone who is a man or someone who is completely different to me. And it is really important for parents to have those conversations with their children when they're young, because that allows choice to really open up. And for me, as I detail in the book, it really did change my perspective on how I approach people and how I interact with people and how people then in turn interact with me.
And Tanika, your father too was very open to you choosing your own future.
Yeah, so as I detail in the book, and there's an entire chapter growing up black in America, my dad really spoke about race to me, because many black parents, especially in the U.S., have to teach their black children about race and survival and how to interact with the police and the way we have to act differently than other white kids. We're not going to get away with the things that they might get away with. So it wasn't an unusual thing for me to have this conversation in particular with him. I think I was about 17. Yeah, he just said that, you know, you might meet someone who's not black and it's okay for you to be with them. And that conversation really stuck with me. And Alex and I only discovered that our dads had had the similar conversation, I think only after we were married. Mm-hmm. We're just having a random conversation. And I remember, like, I brought up the fact about my dad saying that to me when I was a kid. And he also said, oh, my dad said that as well. We just thought that was so interesting that we both had had those conversations and we both are the main people in interracial relationships in both of our families.
Totally. And I think just one other thing to add is the relationship that I now have with Tanika's dad is something that is quite remarkable, because we do live such different lives and he had a completely different upbringing to me. And the way that he has very much opened up to me and been very open with his views about all sorts of things has allowed me to really build that relationship with him. And that's really, I think, helped our marriage, because knowing more about him and Tanika's past gives me a better understanding as to my wife and a little bit more of an insight into the Black experience in the US.
And right from the very beginning, you were determined that this should be an audio book rather than just a written record.
Yes. So when we had offers for the book, we had an option for a more traditional offer. And then we had this offer from Audible. They were just so moved by our proposal and they did chase us and they could bring it to life more and the conversation section. And that was kind of a unique thing, I think, also for Audible, because it was prose with conversations. And they're really well known for their Audible Originals and Audible Original podcasts. And so our book is an audiobook, but at the same time, we have these conversations at the end of some of the chapters. And we've had a lot of feedback from people who listen to the book that it's actually one of their favorite bits. We felt that this story would be done the justice it deserved by being an audio first book, because it's a very emotional book. And we feel that if people are able to first be introduced by this book through listening, they're able to pick up on those emotions that maybe might not come across as strongly in a print book.
And Alex, with your background in journalism as well, did you feel that there was something more immediate about the spoken voice rather than the written word?
Absolutely, yeah. I think the sorts of conversations and the sorts of topics that we discuss as a couple are the sorts of topics and themes that many couples would discuss while they're, I don't know, in their living room or while they're making dinner or something like that. They're very much conversations that we hope couples will listen to and then have themselves. And what we've tried to avoid is creating something which is instructive or didactic. We present our experiences as a couple and our conversations and the challenges that we've gone through, not in the way that says we have approached it like this and you should do the same, but in we've had this kind of experience. What's your experience been like? And we really have seen from the way that people have written to us after the publication that this book has spurred many different conversations in many different couples all over the world.
And Alex, I believe you also have a personal reason why you want the book to be available to people who might not be able to read the page.
Absolutely, yes. My grandmother on my mother's side is a fantastic woman called Ingrid, who's originally from Germany, but she's lived in the UK for over 50 years now. And she's well into her 90s now, and she's currently dealing with macular degeneration. And she's a very important person in my life. And even though she's into her 90s, she's still very active when it comes to listening to audiobooks, to podcasts, to news broadcasts. And she'll call me on FaceTime on her iPad and want to discuss the latest podcast she's listened to, or she'll ask, did you hear this audiobook? And I think she's taught me a lot about what life is like for people with sight difficulties. And she has increasing difficulty reading. But she's been a real inspiration to me throughout my life. And being able to produce this book in an audio format, which she would be able to engage with and hopefully enjoy, was definitely a motivation for me.
The world has changed. And while progress has been achieved, we must not let those holding on to the scraps of a racially segregated and erroneous past prevent us from moving towards a rich and diverse future. And that future includes interracial relationships and families. When I first started dating Alex, and in the first few years of our marriage, race wasn't really so much of a topic or a problem. Yes, we had some friends that made comments about us dating outside of our race, but it wasn't until I started to realize who I was as a Black woman and started standing up for myself against inappropriate comments that we started to have problems. Most of which was when Alex would not stand up for me when our friends said comments that I found to be racist, no matter how subtle, or couldn't understand how I felt when I had a racist encounter. And sometimes he would even defend the people who I felt offended by.
Tanika Smith, narrating Mixed Up, Confessions of an Interracial Couple. While the book details some of the more unpleasant things that you've had to experience, there is clearly a lot of joy in there as well. Are you hopeful that things are moving in the right direction as far as acceptance and proper understanding are concerned, Tanika?
Absolutely. I'm definitely hopeful. We've just seen the first vice president elect in history, Kamala Harris, who is a woman who is of South Asian descent, who is Black, and she's in an interracial marriage, you know, to the first Jewish second gentleman. And so I'm very hopeful. We've seen the change that the Black Lives Matter movement has brought so far. It hasn't been easy change, but change is never easy and it's never quick. But the most permanent change happens in incremental steps. And I definitely do see that happening. I think for me, the scary part would be if this just becomes another trend, another news cycle, and people stop talking about it, stop fighting for it, stop supporting. And we have to continue to keep up the conversation. I know that racism is an uncomfortable topic for many people. They're getting tired of hearing about it all the time, that they just need to imagine what it's like to be someone that has to live it every single day. Racial equality is about everyone being equal, is about everyone having that privilege. And movements such as the Black Lives Matter movement isn't trying to take away privilege from white people. It's trying to make privilege equal for everyone. Mm. And that doesn't mean taking away privilege. That just means giving it to everyone, no matter their background, their skin color, their culture, or religion. So that's my hope as well.
And my hope from my side is that people will continue to educate themselves and challenge their way of thinking. And that applies to white people and people from all sorts of different races as well. Yes, it's challenging. It's difficult. It's not a walk in the park, but it's something that we must do, and creating a more equal society for all.
Alex Court, Tanika Smith, thank you so much for being guests on Read On and for giving us some greater insight into your book, Mixed Up: Confessions of an Interracial Couple.
Thank you so much, Red.
Thank you so much for having us.
Mixed Up by Alex Court and Tanika Smith is available commercially and hopefully will be coming to the RNIB Library very soon.
This is Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. And now, before we return to Sally Gardner to hear the books of her life...
Like many writers this year, Charlotte Levin's debut novel, If I Can't Have You, came out while the country was in lockdown. But judging by the glowing reviews online, that hasn't dampened readers' enthusiasm for the book. Charlotte will join me in a moment via Zoom. But for now, let's have a listen to the audio version of If I Can't Have You, read by Chloe Massey.
I often think about the first time I saw you, when they broke the news that Dr. Williams had been killed at the weekend. Dr. Harris and Dr. Short had gathered everyone into the surgery waiting room, even menials like myself, and Harris relayed the shocking details. You may as well hear it from me, as there'll only be speculation. Mrs. Williams. An argument. The car that hit him as he ran across the road after her. How he was still alive when the ambulance arrived. How he was dead before they could get him into it. I heard it all. The terrible events. The intakes of breath. Linda blubbing next to me. I heard. But it was you who held my concentration. You were the stranger among us. Kept your head down in respect. Or was it embarrassment? Your hair fell forward, draping your face in that way it does, and when you glanced up, your eyes, pale, unsettled me.
It's about a young woman called Constance Little, and she's left Manchester for London following her mother's death. She starts a job in a private medical surgery, and essentially, the book is about her. She starts a relationship with one of the doctors called Samuel Stevens, and she thinks she's found happiness and everything she's been missing in life, and then he ends it. And the story is essentially her descent into obsession and her unravelling. So on the surface, it's a stalker novel. It has a thriller element, but it's really also about loneliness and attachment and how far we'll go to have that attachment to somebody in life.
It certainly hits the ground running. Tell us about that scene in the tube.
Yeah, so it opens with a young woman who you realise is Constance, and she's on a tube and she's in a wedding dress. She's covered in blood. She's got vomit in her veil and her tooth is hanging out. So that's how it starts. And then the book starts from the beginning and essentially explains how she got into that state. Starts with a bang.
When Constance is with Samuel, as a reader, we can see the red flags, but she can't.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's how I wanted to write it. It had to be from Constance's point of view. She just can't see it, even though the reader can. So it's sort of quite uncomfortable to watch her just continue with her behaviours, knowing all along that he's just very much not worth it and doesn't feel the same as she does about him.
And there was a thread on Twitter a wee while back that Constance isn't alone in ignoring red flags.
No. A few years ago, my friend was staying for the weekend and we were talking about relationships and our exes and how did we know really before we went out with them? And that was opened up on Twitter for discussion and it went a bit viral. There was lots of people, because I think it's quite a common thing that we see red flags, but generally in hindsight after the event, and we willingly ignored them as the relationship was happening because we like the person. So that's very much what Constance is doing in this.
And Reverend that Samuel does, he sees himself as the good guy.
Yeah, I think it was very important. I didn't want to make him just a stereotypical baddie. I think it was important that everybody, Constance and Samuel and other characters, do believe that they're doing their best in life. I mean, he is awful consciously sometimes as well, but I think he's quite oblivious to his behaviour because he's so innately selfish that he's just driven by what he wants to do. But that's the same with Constance and her relationship with Dale. And, you know, I touch on that towards the end, that as people, we're often very unaware of how we can affect other people.
Now, you obviously wrote this before the current situation, but do you think there's a certain relevance about loneliness and isolation, especially during lockdown?
Yeah, well, I've not seen anyone for 5 months, so it feels very relevant to me right now. Loneliness is a huge theme in the book. Constance talks about being in London and being around 9 million people, but it's irrelevant because if you don't have that connection, we can feel very lonely regardless of how many people are around. But I should imagine that during the past few months, loneliness has hit a lot of people quite severely. And I'm a bit of a loner anyway. I'm an only child, and I must admit I do like my own company, and I live on my own and I work from home. Even this is too extreme for me, but I'm probably more used to it than the average person. And there's a lot of people that were just literally thrown into not being able to see anyone, and I should imagine that's really hit a lot of people very hard.
What about as a writer, have you been writing much in lockdown?
Well, you'd think that it was the perfect opportunity to write, and I've found it incredibly difficult. I started writing my second book, but I do suffer quite badly with anxiety, and I was quite anxious when all this started. I'm used to it now, but it just wasn't really a situation to get your creative juices going. Just going out, or you see things or you hear things, and it triggers things creatively, and just being in the same four walls isn't really conducive to that. So I found it personally quite difficult. At the beginning I thought, great, I'm going to write a first draft of my next novel, and I'm currently on chapter 3. It didn't quite go to plan.
I believe you've recently got into audiobooks yourself.
Yeah, well, because I was doing this and I thought, I've never actually listened to an audiobook. I've got a really short attention span and I didn't think I'd be able to concentrate on it. And I did. And I listened to a book over the weekend, Daisy Jones and the Six, and it blew me away. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. So now I think I'm an audiobook convert, to be honest.
Charlotte Levin, thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Robert, who is recuperating well and looking forward to picking up the Read On reins again in the new year.
Now it's back to Sally Gardner for the books of her life. Sally, was there a book that you read in your youth that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I've always, always loved words. Words were very, very important to me. I came from a legal family, and because I didn't read, in a way. And when people don't expect very much of you, it's amazing how much they'll talk over you, thinking you don't comprehend and understand. And I understood very well. I had a great vocabulary and I loved collecting words. I just absolutely loved them. And the book that was the happiest book that I remember was Wind in the Willows. And my stepmother read it to us when she was on her honeymoon with my father. And we all went along, my brother and me. And I remember my brother was given a cot in their bedroom. And he was about 9 or 10, which he slept in all the time because my father was a notorious miser, very tight with money. And I think it would have cost more to get a bed in. So he slept crunched up in this cot. But in the morning, we would clamber into bed and my stepmother, Joan, would read us Wind in the Willows. And it was the most magical reading. And she did that wonderful scene with Mole and the picnic basket where Ratty takes Mole out for a picnic. And it's written on the book with no punctuation. It just runs in to all the things they have in the picnic basket. And she did it with one breath. To this day, I sort of think, wow, that was pretty amazing. And it was just magical. It was absolutely magical, her reading that. And it's one of the happiest memories I have of her.
Ratty, said the mole suddenly, one bright summer morning, if you please, I want to ask you a favour. Won't you take me to call on Mr. Toad? I've heard so much about him, and I do so want to make his acquaintance. Why, certainly, said the good-natured Rat. Get the boat out and we'll paddle up there at once. It's never the wrong time to call on Toad. Early or late, he's always the same fellow. Always good-tempered, always glad to see you, always sorry when you go. He must be a very nice animal, observed the mole, as he got into the boat and took the sculls, while the Rat settled himself comfortably in the stern. He is indeed the best of animals, replied Rat. So simple, so good-natured, and so affectionate. Perhaps he's not very clever, we can't all be geniuses, and it may be that he is both boastful and conceited, but he has got some great qualities, has Toadie. Rounding a bend in the river, they came in sight of a handsome, dignified old house of mellowed red brick, with well-kept lawns reaching down to the water's edge. There's Toad Hall, said the Rat, and that creek on the left, where the notice board says, Private, no landing allowed, leads to his boathouse, where we leave the boat.
Richard Bryars narrating The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham, which is available from the RNIB Library. The Michael Horden version is available commercially. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
There's so many, but the book that I finally settled on as one I do go back to so much that it feels a bit like a comfort blanket is Pride and Prejudice. And I just love that book. I'm in awe of Jane, in the small domesticity of the world she creates. I remember when I first listened to it, because I think I listened to it through an RNIB recording, and I remember thinking this was a thriller. I was on the edge of my seat, you know, would she get together with Darcy? Would it happen? Because near the end, where everyone's going, oh, he's the most dreadful man in the world, she is so desperate to get near him, to say, I know what you did. And every time she's nearly there, you know, her mother goes, oh, come here, Lizzie, and play. The poor girl is dragged off again. And you just think, they're never going to get together. They're never, ever going to do it. They're never. I love that book. And I love the fact that Darcy's love for her comes as such an overwhelming car crash to this young woman. It's a beautiful book.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. However little known the feelings or views of such a man may be on his first entering a neighbourhood, this truth is so well fixed in the minds of the surrounding families that he is considered as the rightful property of some one or other of their daughters.
My dear Mr. Bennet, said his lady to him one day, have you heard that Netherfield Park is let at last? Mr. Bennet replied that he had not. But it is, returned she, for Mrs. Long has just been here, and she told me all about it. Mr. Bennet made no answer. Do not you want to know who has taken it? Cried his wife impatiently.
You want to tell me,
and I have no objection to hearing it.
Emilia Fox, narrating Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, the book I read recently, which I really did love, is Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid. It's read by Nicola Lewis, and it is a really neat and interesting idea about a black babysitter who gets not arrested, but gets accosted to be arrested in a supermarket because she's looking after a little girl. It is a wonderful story. It's a sort of, I suppose I was trying to think of it this morning, it's a bit, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Could be one of the ways you could look at this book. It's a book that has a twist, but don't go, oh, that's pretty obvious. Wait, just go to the very end, because at the end, it's just delicious twisting and it goes boom, boom. It's wonderful. And also, I'd like to say the best young child I've ever seen written in a book for grown-ups. The child is extraordinarily well observed.
Between 2001 and 2004, Alix Chamberlain sent over 100 letters and received over $900 worth of merchandise. These free products included coffee beans, Luna bars, makeup samples, scented candles, putty to hang posters on the walls in her dorm room, magazine subscriptions, sunscreens, and face masks, all of which Alix shared with her roommates and other girls on her floor. While she majored in marketing and minored in finance, Alix did product reviews for a student newspaper during her sophomore and junior years at NYU. In her senior year, she quit the newspaper to become a beauty intern at a tiny publication, but she didn't stop sending letters.
Nicole Lewis, narrating Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid, which is available commercially. Sally Gardner, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
I'm really honoured to be on your programme, by the way. Thank you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And we're always available to download as a podcast. Simply search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell, and producer Robert is at Talking_Books. Thanks again to stand-in producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to all of you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on!